theory provides radical new departures to the fundamental framework for cosmology. Unfortunately, in the process, it poses new problems as well. So some of these new connections are in the context of inflation. So we'll hear several talks on brain inflation. Then it appears that there is a string theory landscape with a large number of vacua, counting these vacua in such a way as to predict whether or not you end up with our universe is a topic of one talk, and chain inflation is a topic of another. So if you're in the context of string theory, you can't write down arbitrary cosmological solutions. So the time-dependent solutions of string theory are also going to be a topic of some of the discussion. Of course, another hook for the contact between these two areas is the cosmological discovery of dark energy, which leads you to wonder, well, what is going on with the cosmological constant, and so on and so forth. Among the problems that string theory produces for cosmology are the moduli stabilization issues, and we're going to hear about that. So along the following the gong show tradition, no matter how talented you are or your talks are, the gong will go off in 5 minutes. So we're hoping that all the speakers, I really don't want to have to send off the gong. So please restrict yourselves to about 2 transparencies. And the order of the talks is here. We'll start with Mark Jackson, Collisions of Cosmic F and D Strings. Please restrict questions to short ones and longer conversation till afterwards.
Katie. So, So as Katie said, I'll be telling you about collisions of cosmic superstrings. As you heard this morning, cosmic superstrings are ubiquitous in models of brain inflation. But as the superstrings are produced, they don't just sit there, they move around and they wiggle. As they move around, one of two things could happen. As they fly towards each other, nothing could happen, and they just fly out the other side. Or as they fly towards each other, they could reconnect. So let's say that they reconnect with some probability p, and nothing happens with probability 1 minus p. Well, in gauge theory, when we study these usual old type of cosmic strings, the probability is actually 1. As long as they're not flying at about the speed of light, they will always reconnect. With cosmic superstrings, however, that's not at all the case. With superstrings, scattering is really just some sort of path integral that you're going to do, so you know it has to be probabilistic. In fact, we can actually compute this probability. Set up as just a standard scattering problem where you study the scattering of these wound states. And in some work I did with Nick Jones and Joel Polchinski, we found that the answer for the scattering of two fundamental strings was given by the formula above. So it's really just a function of the relative angle between the strings and of the relative velocity that they're flying towards each other at. We were also able to do the case of two D strings. So this is a non-perturbative result, because as you know, D strings have a tension which is proportional to 1 over G. And we find that there's the usual factor of e to the minus 1 over G in the answer here. So it is a non-perturbative result. I'd also like to mention that the way that we computed the DD scattering was actually a bit hand-wavy. It was actually done properly in a beautiful paper by Hanani and Hashimoto, as Hashimoto talked about this morning. But that's not the end of the story. We know that superstrings also have a wave function which has to live in the extra dimensions, which are usually taken to be compact. So this is going to have some sort of effect on the probability, because when we study probability, what we're really doing is studying the overlap of wave functions. Well, what could we do to study these wave functions? We could try the simplest possible thing. We could say that the wave function in the compact dimensions are just zero modes. So the wave function is evenly spread out in the compact dimensions. So this would have the obvious effect that it would just sort of suppress the probability that we computed otherwise with sort of the volume factor of the compact dimensions, because the wave function has to spread out now. Or we could try to be a little more sophisticated, and we say that, well, maybe the wave function's not evenly spread out. that maybe it has some effective width to it because there's potential in the compact dimensions, usually this warp factor, which will give the wave function some effective width. So this gives some sort of reduction in the probability. Well, as we all know, the one potential that we can easily solve is the simple harmonic oscillator potential. We just take the potential to be quadratic, and it turns out we can actually compute this exactly. This is done not just for the simple harmonic oscillator case, where we have only a zero mode. In the string case, we actually have an infinite tower of modes. But these can all be summed, and this sum produces this logarithmic effect that we see here. So between these two cases that we can do perfectly, the quadratic case or the zero mode case, we can actually study a lot of interesting physics. So the most interesting one that we know of right now is the compactification found in the KKLMMT model. So this is what's known as a Klebanoff-Strassler geometry. And it has the geometry of an R3 cross an S3, where the R3 is really a 3D harmonic oscillator. So between the two cases that I just told you about, we can do this exactly. And the result is what I showed you here. The G's and the M's are the parameters that we put into the model. So I remember in Henry Tai's talk this morning, it was asked, well, if we did see cosmic strings, would we be able to tell anything interesting about string theory? Well, we could tell a lot of interesting things about string theory. We can read off not only the coupling, obviously that's going to affect the probability, but we see here the compactification makes a large amount of difference in the probability that we see. And so by measuring these cosmic strings that we see in the sky and how likely they are to interact, we'd actually be able to find out a lot about the geometry. So that's it. Are there any questions? Okay. Yes. Oh. Right. So the way that you would.
How would you observe the interactions between the strings?
So the way that you would observe the interactions, you would either have to be extraordinarily lucky and actually watch them, right? Or it actually turns out that the probability makes a difference in what's called the scaling solution, how much string we would actually expect to see in the sky. And so if we observed a lot of events, that's just one parameter, right? But well, that one parameter, you would measure the probability, the likelihood, but then you might be able to tell other things from that probability.
Check.
Our next speaker is Ben Schlaer, cosmic string lensing and closed time-like curves.
So I'm presenting cosmic string lensing and closed time-like curves. This is work done with Henry Tai in a recent paper. So why are cosmic strings interesting? The answer is because they allow us to test the brain world. Cosmic strings are almost a generic prediction of brain inflation. And many models predict cosmic string tensions that are both realistic, but also not so small that they can't be ruled out or confirmed in near future experiments. A direct observation of a cosmic string might look something like this, where we have very cosmic stringy, two identical undistorted images, or as Henry pointed out earlier, also maybe a partially cropped image, but also undistorted. And the reason for this image is because the geometry due to a cosmic string is a cone. And the deficit angle of that cone is given by the tension, 8 pi g mu. And the observed angular separation between the two images, delta phi, is also related just to that tension or deflection angle, delta. When the string is moving, the lensing is a bit more interesting. what we have here is a particle or a photon incident upon a moving cosmic string. The angle between the particle and the string's velocity is alpha, and the deficit angle is Lorentz contractor here in this coordinate system. And the interesting thing is that not only is there a jump in the angle, a deflection angle, there's also a spatial and a temporal jump in the world line of the particle. The discontinuity is, of course, just a coordinate effect. But in this image up here, we have the point A is identified with the point B, and also A is simultaneous with the point C. That's because the particle jumped backwards in time due to the relativity of simultaneity. It's quite easy to calculate the final form momentum of the incident particle just by boosting into the cosmic string's rest frame, where we know that the identification is a simple rotation, and then boost back to our laboratory frame. An interesting result that came out of this is that we corrected an error in the literature in Blink in 1986. We find that the deflection angle is enhanced by the relativistic gamma factor and not suppressed, so that could be quite a significant effect. Also, generically, there's blue shifting, and because of a combination of the jump in time as well as very large values of the product of the string tension and the relativistic gamma factor, we find that it's possible to have deflection angles of order pi, and then two cosmic strings would be able to trap a particle. It turns out because of the delta t, this trapping is a closed time-like curve. So there are closed time-like curves in the presence of rapidly moving pairs of cosmic strings. This was discovered by Gott in 1991. So we analyzed this scenario, and we found that an interesting feature of the two-string system is that a generic particle is attracted to an orbit, a stable orbit. So following this picture, we have a particle come in at a generic angle, would strike a cosmic string which is moving to the left up here, and in the presence of another cosmic string moving to the right down here. This is sort of a top-down picture where the deficit angle is pictured there and there. And the trajectory is just a spiral outward into the stable orbit, where it remains. But in combination with this attractive solution, we find always a blue-shifted, that is, when the particle jumps, it is also blue-shifted. So there's an exponential divergence in the particle's energy, and we can be sure that the back reaction will destroy the Gott spacetime. So there is no Gott spacetime in the presence of particles or dynamical fields. So in conclusion, moving strings lends more, and any dynamical field spoils the Gott spacetime. Questions? In principle, yes, because this only depends on the fact that there's a shortcut. Whenever you have two geodesics, the one that's closer to the string will be longer, and the Y junction has that property. So moving Y junctions would also have potential Gott spacetimes associated with them. But this effect would also destroy them.
I have a quick question. This error you found in Vilenkin's work, does it have any effect on the regular cosmic strings?
Well, it just means when we're... I'm not sure if it would change any of the present bounds. I don't think so. But you just have to be more careful when you're analyzing, say, the upper bound on cosmic string tension when looking at a lensing event.
Well, let's thank our speaker again.
Okay.
So our next speaker Our next speaker is Doug Spoliar, talking about chain inflation.
So, so this was work done both with Katie Fries and Jim Liu. And these are the have pH numbers on the relevant papers. So inflation really has two basic requirements, that you both provide a sufficient amount of inflation, but also that at the end of inflation, that the universe will reheat and thermalize and provide the standard cosmology. Old inflation, with just a single tunneling field, failed to do both of these things. But here with multiple tunneling fields, each responsible for only a small fraction of an E-folding, but by tunneling quickly enough, we can provide the graceful exit, but due to the fact we have such a large number of fields, or rather tunneling events, should be said, that we can then provide a sufficient amount of inflation. So the basic picture is one can imagine just simply a tilted cosine where we can a large number of vacua, and the tunneling rate is sufficiently high enough that we can have the graceful exit. This requires that the amount of inflation per stage is less than one-third of an E-folding, and then this would require that the number of stages that we have would be then larger than a certain amount to provide the sufficient amount of inflation, roughly speaking about 200 as a bare minimum. So then one might really wonder, where can you think about where this can kind of pop up? One consideration would be the stringy landscape, where you have a large number of vacua that are connected to other vacua, so you have a lot of different directions that one can go into. So one can then tunnel both quickly, but since there are so many vacua that we can provide a sufficient amount of inflation. And we can also do this with the real QCD axion, not just something that one cooks up, but the actual QCD axion. So the nice thing about this model also is that in a sense you have that one, wrong transparency, sorry about that. So in reality, the nice thing about this is that the fields that you have require no fine-tuning. In actuality, if you fine-tune it, the whole scenario breaks down. And this also works at a huge or large range of scales, both from the gut scale all the way down to 10 MeV. And it also saves old inflation. So thank you.
Time for a few questions. Fernando?
What do you mean by that? In the paper that we wrote on for doing it in the landscape, we considered a large number of coupled double wells, or asymptotic double wells. And for the axion, that's a cosine type of. And so in that circumstance, it's a cosine for that particular thing. But one might try to consider this more generally, and to consider it in terms of tilted cosine seems to be quite a reasonable way to think about it.
There was another question.
Well, the assumption would be is that it would be quite quick. I mean, I think that the argument would be that you'd have to be less than, as I said, less than a third, such that you get a graceful exit at each stage. So in reality, you're really moving through this thing awfully quickly.
Well, let's thank our speaker again.
So our next speaker is Jan-Peter van der Skaar, tunneling away from the thermal to sitter vacuum.
In less than 5 minutes.
Yeah, these are very extremely rapid tunneling events.
So I know you want to hear the gong, so I will just keep on talking until actually I'm over time, because you know this doesn't make sense. Where's my other slide, Katie? Oh, okay, great. Okay, great. So I want to take this opportunity to tell you something about something that's very much work in progress. So I just want to test this idea a little bit. And I would love to hear comments from you, either now or after the talk. So let me know what you think. So as I said, very preliminary. And this is work, ongoing work that it should be going on right now as we speak, if Malik is actually doing something. But it's a work in progress with Brian and Malik. And so I'd love to hear your comments. And this, what I try to show here is basically a pictorial summary of this summarized talk already. So you heard this morning something about, the initial state problem during inflation, and that we really have to think hard about how do we actually pick initial state, and maybe we should not be satisfied with the usual procedure where we basically pick the Bunch-Davis state. Now, this is what I want to discuss today is basically a toy example, and it will not be probably will not be phenomenologically interesting, but I think it's a very calculable, well-motivated example of an initial state modification that doesn't require any new physics, in fact. So let me just try to give you the grasp of the crux of the idea. So typically what we do is actually we start out with a Bunch-Davis state, and then you know that if you go to you can understand this roughly speaking, if you go to this side of the slide as going into the direction of using a co-moving frame, and if you take the Bunch-Davis state and you go to a co-moving frame, then you know that actually the primordial spectrum of perturbations that you get is just something that looks like this, where I just focus on a scalar field, a master scalar field in my sitter background. However, if I go into the other direction, then basically what this line represents is basically going to a frame where I look at a free-falling observer. So I look at an undo detector that is carried by a free-falling observer. Then I know that this Bunch-Davis state actually corresponds to a thermal spectrum, which is what this represents. This is basically an emission rate, and I'll try to explain that a little bit more later on. And so we know that this corresponds for a free-falling observer to a thermal state. Now, what I'm going to discuss in these 5 minutes, if I get there, what I want to discuss is actually consider a slight modification of this thermal emission rate, which we're going to assume is going to be corrected by considering back reaction effects. And there's a little star here, which basically means that you should look at these nodes here. And the way we're going to actually calculate these back reaction effects, so we're basically going to consider the back reaction of these radiated quanta. The way we're going to do that is by using a model in which the sitter radiation is interpreted in terms of a tunneling event. And this was actually beautifully described in the context of black holes by Maulik, Parik, and Frank Wilczek in an old paper. But Maulik then went on and also showed that you can do this in the sitter space as well. So you consider the sitter radiation as a tunneling process, and you can consider the effect, you have to include the effect of back reaction in this setup. So now, once you have this corrected emission rate, then you can try to interpret that, actually we will interpret that, as actually a change in the state that you actually choose for this scalar field. So instead of using the Bunch-Davis state, which is going to give you this thermal spectrum, we're going to say that, hey, we need something like a tunneling state, a T state. And this T state, when you act on it with your free-falling operators, your natural free-falling operators, look at the expectation value of the number operator, actually should give you this emission rate. Now, once we have this T state, we can go back and actually calculate the spectrum of primordial fluctuations. And because this is no longer the Bunch-Davis state, we then find some corrections. So this is basically, I can stop here, but I won't because I want to hear the gong. this is basically the whole idea of this of this work. So now I thought I still would have 4 minutes, but apparently I don't. And so just let me mention that this tunneling approach, what this implies is actually that you consider this radiation in the sitter space as basically the tunneling event of a quantum basically across the horizon that surrounds a free falling observer in the sitter space. And to have basically a natural scale which determines the barrier of this tunneling event, you should take into account back reaction. Because as this quantum actually leaves the horizon, the horizon will slightly shift, which corresponds to basically the barrier that you put up for this quantum to actually reach the observer. Now you can actually calculate this tunneling event, and what is extremely nice is that this corresponds to basically the exponent of delta S, where S corresponds to the gravitational entropy of your system. So S is basically the area of the De Sitter horizon divided by 4g. Now, note that this suggests, by taking into account this back reaction, suggests the restoration of unitarity, because delta S is actually what you typically would find in a scattering event. So if you look at the particle physics amplitude, then you basically average over... Great. Any comments? Ideas, questions? No time? Okay, good. Oh, anyway. Thank you.
Testing.
So our next speaker is Jason Kumar, landscape cartographer.
Hi, so I'm going to talk about some work I did with James Wells, and at the end, if I have time, I might talk a little bit about some new ideas we've been thinking about, some more speculative ideas. So basically, there are two main types of questions you can try to ask using the landscape. And one question is basically, which vacuum do we live in? Another way to put it is, you know, what type of manifolds you compactify on, what fluxes do you turn on, where do the complex structure moduli get fixed, so that at low energy you get a model which looks like the standard model with all the right masses and couplings and everything. And in many ways, using a landscape for that is a question of how can you provide input for string model building. Another question you could ask, though, is why do we live in that vacuum as opposed to any of the other consistent string vacua, including vacua with large amounts of supersymmetry. And that's in many ways a question of, you know, trying to find a vacuum selection principle. And people often think about things like the anthropic principle or statistics or a theory of initial conditions in that way. And what we're mostly going to focus on, though, is the question of how to use the landscape for model building. And so for model building, what you really need are selection criteria, right? Criteria used to decide what kind of models you're going to look at to match against the real world. Things like getting the right gauge group, getting proton stabilization, small cosmological constant, et cetera. But you don't want selection criteria which are too generic, because if there are many string vacua which have those properties, then even if you find a model which satisfies your selection criteria, it's probably not the right one. It's probably not one whose low energy is really the real world. And it might not even get you close to the real world. What you'd really like instead is to find a set of features of the real world which are easy to handle from a model building point of view, but which are very non-generic, so that if you can find a model which has it, it's essentially a very good cut removing all the sort of the wrong vacua and getting you closer to the right one. So what you'd like are to find are distributions of observable parameters on the landscape. And so one of the initial steps which we made, at least, was to look at the gauge group rank arising from D3 brains. And some related work was done by Conlon and Quevedo. And so if you just try to find the distribution of the gauge group rank on flux vacua for some orientable with Calabi-Yau, it's actually characterized very simply in terms of an ensemble average of the number of D3 brains. And the ensemble on which you're averaging is just where you count each flux vacuum once. where by a flux vacuum I mean a choice of fluxes and complex structure moduli so that the F-term equations are satisfied. And in that case, you find that the average is just given by L star over 2n plus 3, where n is the number of complex structure moduli of the Calabi-Yau which are not projected out by the oriental fold. And L star is just the D free brain charge of the background, which is just given by the oriental fold planes. And then the probability density is just given by an exponential where R is the rank of the is the rank which you're finding. And that's a somewhat interesting formula, just because it doesn't depend at all on the details of the Calabi-Yau. It doesn't depend on the singularity structure, what the geometric data is, or anything. It just depends on very basic topological data. So you can this kind of probability density is applicable to a wide variety of oriental fold and Calabi-Yau compactifications. And you can also look in the small cosmological constant limit, and you find that you have the same kind of exponential density, except that your average is, instead, it's slightly different. It's given by L star over 2n plus 2. And what that tells you is that the cosmological constant and the gauge group rank are actually slightly correlated. Now, the correlation is only very slight, but this type of correlation is exactly the kind of thing you'd look for, because you know, what you'd like to find out eventually is a set of parameters of the real world, which, even though individually might be relatively generic, together they're very non-generic, so that if you, from a string model building point of view, if you can find a model which has those parameters, then you're much more likely to have found a model which matches the real world. And of course, this is just a very first initial step. But hopefully there's more progress to be made. And I don't think I'm really going to have time to discuss the things we're thinking about in terms of vacuum selection principles. But it'd be something I'd love to talk to people with later on in the workshop. So I guess I should just open it up for questions.
We have time for a question.
Back. Okay, if you have time. It's not that short a question, but so basically the idea is, so of course, one can freely doubt whether all these vacua with no moduli really exist, because they're all derived from some effective field theory ideas, which may not be correct. But there are many vacua which have a huge amount of supersymmetry, and you might wonder, well, why don't we live in those vacua? And one idea we had was to think about the possibility of maybe M theory describing nature as an effective theory. And so the premise is that imagine M theory is completely consistent. It has many vacua, including many which are very supersymmetric. And there's one vacuum which, whose low energy description is the real world we see around us, too, within experimental error. You could still imagine that this whole M theory framework really appears as an effective framework. And the analogy I'd give is QCD. QCD is a perfectly consistent theory. It doesn't break down at any energy scale. But it still only appears in nature as an effective theory. And there are parameters like the dynamical scale, or more generic, if you look at a standard model GET, there are all sorts of masses and couplings which you can continuously change and still have a consistent effective theory. But you imagine that there's a string vacuum, which is a more fundamental theory, which is outputting an effective theory with one set of parameters and not with any other. Now, if you imagine M theory itself being an effective theory, then in some sense, the vacua of M theory could be sort of the moral analogs of the parameters of a standard model GET effective theory, where you have this consistent framework with all these different consistent vacua. But maybe there's a more fundamental theory which sort of outputs M theory at one particular vacuum. And that could select the vacuum which describes the real world above maybe any other vacuum which is consistent from the point of view of M theory. And that's, in a nutshell, the idea. Of course, it's extremely speculative, of course. But just an idea of how you could see something aside from anthropics and statistics, which doesn't require you to say that these vacua are inconsistent within M theory. So wonder if there's maybe a consistency argument for why you don't, as opposed to, say, an anthropic argument for why they're not selected.
Good? Like this? Better? Even better. Perfect.
Our next speaker, Horace Stoica, is going to talk about fast presented, fast quenching.
Okay. So my transparencies are in fact papers, so I presume it is visible. Well, anyway, I prefer to go ahead like this. So the work has been done at McGill with Jim Klein and two of his students. It's been published in this paper, which doesn't have this particular title, but the paper discusses also some implications for cosmology, which I will present here. So right before we start, you can spot a mistake. Today is on the 28th, so let me go on to the first paper. So what we are actually analyzing, we look at the classical tachyon action, and we look at how small fluctuations of this field evolve, and we want to use this to get some insight into the formation of topological defects in tachyon condensation. Okay, thank you. So we start out by analyzing the formation of kinks, and we use the usual real tachyon action. There are two regimes in which we can solve Wiedel equation. One is in the case when the field is uniform, but this is not interesting for the formation of defects. We can also solve the equation very easily in Minkowski space and take into account all the variations in all, all spatial directions. And if we want to look for the formation of kinks, one region where we can easily solve this complicated equation is the point where the tachyon field crosses zero. So for this, we take an ansatz in which we approximate the field profile as linear in the close to the zero crossing, and we allow the slope to evolve as a function of time. So in this particular equation, we included the effect of the Hubble expansion, but this is not essential. You can drop it completely, still you get the same behavior. What we obtain is that the defects form in finite time. So the slope becomes infinite in finite time. This is in accord to the more exact treatment for tachyon condensation. So if we can also analyze the formation of tachyon vortices, and for this we have to use a complex tachyon, which has a slightly different action. This comes from the fact that there are, in fact, two square roots, and when you multiply them together, you get this expression for the action. And the equations are not so ugly, are a little bit simpler. And for a tachyon vortex, we can choose the profile to be linear in two directions. Again, we can solve for the slope. And for this action, we find that the slope doesn't become divergent in finite time, but instead evolves exponentially. If we try to play around also with a naive extension of the real tachyon action to the complex case, and if we use this type of action but with a complex tachyon, we get the divergence in finite time. So if you want to understand what this implies for the formation of defects, we can compare with the case of the phi to the 4 theory, which is much better behaved. So in the case of the phi to the 4 theory, we can use a large damping, and then we just freeze the initial configuration. So here you can see two kinks, two anti-kinks forming. If we have a small damping, then the field can have large oscillations. In this case here, the field can have large oscillations and it can homogenize efficiently, you get no defects. In the case of the tachyon, this runaway form of the potential, what it does, it freezes the original configurations. Once the field starts rolling, whatever profile of the field you have is frozen in place. So the finite time divergence tells you that the lower dimensional brains will form in finite time. So once, so even if you had large oscillations of the field, so even if this tachyon field, even if the tachyon potential would turn around and would have a minimum, the formation of the defects in finite time would the Detroit would form before the field would be able to homogenize. So, in the other case, you saw that for the tachyon vortices, which is the other tachyon action, then the slope doesn't diverge. So, if quantum corrections will result in a tachyon potential which has a minimum, then you may have large oscillations which can restore symmetry and wipe out the defect that were formed. So the density of defects is highly dependent on the exact form of the tachyon action. So I'll stop here.
Time for one short question.
I think this is very interesting, too.
Well, thank you for an interesting talk, and we're actually out of time anyway, so.
Right.
Our next speaker, Xingyang Chen, is speaking about multi-throat brain inflation.
Yeah, okay. So in this talk, I will first introduce a new class of inflationary model as an alternative to the slow inflation, which we call the speed-limit inflation. It's also called, sometimes also called fast-slow inflation in Henry Tao's talk. And then I will realize it in an example of a multi-throat brain inflation model. The usual slow inflation requires a flat potential with a small slow parameter. However, the potential we usually get is a steep one. So in this case, the inflaton just rolls down. We don't have inflation. So in this talk, we will make use of the warp space to slow down the inflaton. So the basic idea is a simple observation is that in this warp space, the transverse velocity of the D3 brain is restricted by the speed of light, which is warp factor squared. R here is proportional to the usual scalar field. The warp factor can be easily made very small, as we have seen in the KSGKP model. This type of inflationary model has been studied in a serious work recently. So we'll be interested in the following model. And this action follows from the DBI transam action. And we are interested, as we mentioned, the steep potential with a large eta parameter. So we do not have a slow potential in this case, but we will make use of the warp space since the inflaton can be held on the top of potential by the infrared end of a warp space. Here's a plot of the warp factor. As we can see, at the same time, when the inflaton is at the top of potential, it is also in the infrared side of the warp space. Since the D3 brain almost saturated the speed limit, the zero mode solution, the leading order of the zero mode solution is given by the speed of light. And this expansion is valid when t is much less than minus h inverse. The lower bound come from various back reactions. This include a D3 brain or multiple D3 brain back reaction or closed string creation by the theta space in the infrared warp space. So combine all these constraints, we can see there's an interesting window where inflation happens. The total number of inflation is given by square root n divided by beta. N is the D3 charge of the throat. So for example, if Roman Neville Schwartz flux number is of order 100, we'll get 100 number of people. So this can be realized in a multi-throat brain inflation. We start with a flux-induced multi-throat compactification with a number of anti-D3 brains. Like D3 brains, the throat will attract anti-D3 brains and annihilate them. But there are two important differences as shown by previous studies. First, for the small number of anti-brains, the annihilation proceeds through quantum tunneling. So that means the anti-brains can have different lifetime in different throats. Second, the end product of annihilation is typically a bunch of D3 brains in the infrared end of the wall factor, in the throat, in the infrared end of the throat. So the D3 brain will move under the moduli potential. Here, we do not need to tune the magnitude of the steepness of this moduli potential. All we need is a sign. So for those repulsive throat to the moduli potential, this D3 brain will exit. So that triggers the speed limit inflation we have been talking about. And the inflation energy can be given either by the anti-D3 brain in the other throats or by the speed potential itself. So this D3 brain will eventually settle down in a bulk or in the end of other throats which has an attractive modular potential. The reheating happens when the D brain collide and annihilate. So a detailed analysis reveals that this kind of model can give, for example, large number of inflationary e-folds. It can give scale invariant density perturbations with some interesting features. And also, it can incorporate random sundial model in this standard model throat with a direct reheating. And also, there's a possible string, cosmic string creation in the anti-brain throat. Also, there's an interesting mechanism to suppress the infrared end of the cosmic microwave background. This is essentially because the long-range quantum fluctuation, the long wavelength quantum fluctuation was generated when the deep brains is in the deep infrared side of the warp space, where the Hubble energy scale is typically bigger than the string scale. There are also many open questions, and I leave it for paper. Thank you very much.
Fernando?
Reheating? Yes, okay. So there are two possibilities. One possibility is the D3 brain exit the B throat, which I denote here, and it settles down in the other throat, which you have anti-D3 brains. So it can happen by brain and brain annihilation, as usual. And the other case, but that has some problem. It's unsettled the problem with the open string creation and the closed string creation. Typically, everything dumps into closed string, and you need to study more carefully in the later process. And there's also another mechanism, because here we're not interested in flat potential, we're interested in genetic speed potential. So the speed potential itself can provide velocities. So in that sense, when a deep brain enters to other throats, it will typically become relativistic. In that case, the collision is more important than annihilation. So presumably, the collision creates much more open string than closed string. So this is two possibilities. Can you say it again? The potential.
Did you put it in my hand?
Oh, the potential here. So the potential here is actually quite similar to the KKLT. So you have one from the conformal coupling, and then the other from the phi dependence from a super potential. And in KKLT, you tune this to cancel each other to some degree of freedom. But here, I'm interested in a sign. So you cancel. Actually, you do not need a fine-tuned cancel, but one contribution is bigger than the other. But all you need is a minus sign. So it's a repulsive throat.
Thank our speaker again. Our next speaker, Sarah Shandera, is going to talk about no fine-tuning in brain inflation.
Okay, thanks. So I'd like to basically take a slightly different take on inflation and come from a more observational point of view and just try and say, what can we do, how can we constrain a very general form of the potential that we get from string theory in terms of the observational constraints. So this is work in progress with Henry Tai. Can you hear me? So that's on. It's on. Okay, a little better. And it's based, there it goes, based in part and very similar in spirit to an earlier paper by Hassan and Henry, which is mentioned here. So as you know, I'm sure this is a very happy time for string cosmology. We have both better and better observational data, and as we've been hearing over the past couple weeks, we're getting more and more of the details right in terms of developing good models of in string theory that contain good cosmology and the standard model and are precisely worked out. So we have choices for inflation models. We can have D3, D3 bar inflation, D3, D7 inflation, as Chen just mentioned, multi-throat inflation, variants of these things. And as we've heard, there's lots of progress on maybe putting in the standard model, the explicitly stabilizing moduli, calculating the form of superpotentials, scalar potentials, and the corrections to that. And all of us have been working very hard, almost all of us, to find slow roll. Of course, it turns out we don't actually need slow roll. So these are many of the authors involved in that part of the work. From the observational side, we can say, first of all, can we see something like cosmic strings, and what is their tension? And secondly, can we match with the rest of the observable parameters that might be measured, for example, in WMAP? So from the observational point of view, all of this hard work over here can just be put into a form of the potential for the inflaton, and then we can use that potential to calculate what we get for the observational stuff. So I'd just like to ask, given the potential motivated by string theory, what do our observational constraints tell us can be the parameters in that potential? So let me give you a sketch and the two main cases so far. Here's the little cartoon of the various scenarios that we can have. The first most well-known scenario is of course, the KKL-MMT slow roll case. So in this case, we're looking for a value of the slow roll parameter that's small. Because we have this dB bar potential in a warp throat, that can be flat enough. But as soon as we take into account effects such as moduli stabilization, we see that the inflaton gets a mass of order h squared, which is too big, basically. So the original conclusion was this means we need a fine-tuning of order 1 part in 100. As you heard from Henry this morning, if you actually reanalyze that by just taking the WMAP observational parameters and saying, what did they impose in terms of what we need for fine-tuning this mass squared, you actually find that it's much less, something like a part in a sixth. So not really a big deal. So this model works quite well. The second case that's very different is the fast roll case that you just heard a lot about. And the big idea here, you know, you take advantage of the DBI motion, you have a potential that maybe looks something like this. This is for the Silverstein-Tong model, not the multi-throat model. And you get something that's a steep potential with a quickly rolling brain, but it still fits all of the parameters that we observe. So this is still a nice model. And also it has some features that might make it actually differentiable from the slow roll case in terms of tensor modes and non-Gaussianities. So given that a slow roll case works, a fast roll case works, let's just say let's take the general case and see what we get. So let's take a potential that has this term that was problematic for the slow roll case, but good for the fast roll case. And in here, we've buried all of the terrible, difficult to calculate physics that we heard about this morning, for example, from Michael Hawk. And let's add to that the dB bar potential that we used for slow roll. And we'll modify it to take into account the fact that the brains can be fast moving, which is roughly a factor of gamma here. You can already see that this potential is a phi squared piece and a 1/5 to the 4th piece. So I have an inflection point. So not only do I have the fast roll regime, but I also have a point where the slow roll parameter is actually small. So I at least have a small region there where I get that, which is helpful. So the scheme is to take that potential and see what we can get. So since I'm hoping to be gonged, let me first show you my conclusions and then come back to the details. Okay. So the basic result of doing all of this is going to be that we're not limited to the slow roll case. We can do everything in general. What we have is a procedure for actually taking this general case and calculating observation. And what it looks like is, at least in the KKL-MMT case, we actually don't need much fine-tuning. OK, so now let me jump back and give you some idea of how to do this. Basically, we can take the potential that I wrote down, or any other potential that you'd like to give me motivated by string theory, take the DBI action to get an equation of motion for the inflaton, take the Friedman equations, and solve for H of phi, Hubble of phi, and also the motion of the brain. Now, rather than using the slow roll parameters, what we can use is a set of parameters that are sort of, they're called the Hubble slow roll expansion, but I really didn't assume any slow roll to write these down. They're here, defined strictly in terms of H, and again modified to have this factor of gamma in them. You can see that the advantage of these, there are two advantages, but one is really that the condition for inflation is just that this parameter epsilon is less than 1, no less. And when epsilon equals 1, that's precisely when inflation ends. So we can do a nice expansion in terms of these. And it's easy to write the usual slow roll parameters in terms of these parameters and translate between the two. Also, when this parameter is much, much less than 1, you recover the slow roll case. So we can expand all of our observables in these parameters and additional factors coming from the motion of the brain and use those to compute limits on the parameters back up in the potential here. So let me give you an example of how this works. There are several nifty examples. The first is just that when I'm calculating the number of e-folds, because I have a 1 over v prime, it's easier to get enough e-folds of inflation. A more interesting example is actually calculating the scalar index here. In the slow roll case, this parameter, epsilon and eta, are very, very small. So I get a small contribution here. In the fast roll case, you might think, well, these parameters are getting larger, so I'm going to go outside of my bound for ns minus 1. But actually, you get a really neat cancellation here due to this extra term that has a dependence on gamma prime. So you get something that goes as epsilon squared. So you actually get something that's small enough again in that case. You also have interesting interplay between the tensor modes, the nonlinearities, and this gamma parameter. I'm just going to keep going, so go ahead. And basically, when you increase gamma, you see that. Thank you.
I'm afraid we don't have time for questions.
Yeah, please.
Our next speaker is Louis LeBlanc, brain reheating from DD bar annihilation.
Thank you. Everybody can hear me? Yep. Okay, so. Okay, this. So I would like to talk about, again, this is 5 minutes, so I just want to talk about some work in progress in collaboration with Nick Jones at Amsterdam University. And so I will welcome any ideas or comments. So a very interesting part of inflation is the exit of brain inflation with DD bar, and that's what I would be mainly concerned with. And this is very interesting. So when DD bar usually ends up with the DD annihilation of the brain and anti-brain, which is done with tachyon condensation, and then the vacuum energy that was coming from the tension of the two brains must go to something. And the usual folklore is that they actually just go all closed string, but this is, I will show you, it's just very leaning order analysis, and we can do, you know, we can do better than that. And so, also, this is a very interesting part because the low energy effect of action is no longer valid, and you have stringy physics that comes in. That's, for example, cosmic string. And this, by testing this, we can really test stringy physics. Of course, reheating is not as constrained by observable as cosmic string can be, and so really we only need a certain amount of energy in the standard model brains such that the temperature is enough so that we get BBN and all the usual Big Bang cosmology. So the question I would like to ask is, what is the branching fraction of DD bar to go over to open string versus closed string? So I'm going to suppose I have open string degrees of freedom around, and I want to find a branching fraction. So we really want to think about this, about like an accelerator, and I have like a one event in my accelerator, and I want to know the branching fraction. Okay, and that will come the reheating, the energy from that collision. Okay, so to leading order, DD bar goes to closed string. This is the result by Liu, Lambert, and Malacena. Before it was interpreted as cosmic matter, but really it's just closed string. We know actually not only that it goes all to closed string, but also we know the properties of these closed strings. They're left, right, and identical. They're non-relativistic, and they're very massive, and actually there's more. And the idea of this calculation, which I just want to summarize a little bit, is that we think of this system as a time-dependent source that creates a current state of this form. And then this eight aggregates is a creation operator for a physical closed string. And this one loop here, one of, there's just this amplitude here, the one point function on the disk with the DDBAR boundary state, which is, was given by Sen here. This is just the zero mode part, and this is all we need. And this is leading order. Actually, this diagram is order zero, so zeroth order in Z string. And so the idea is to calculate the actual number, total number of closed string emitted, which for current state, so you just calculate the back, the expectation value of the number operator, giving the in and out state, and then you get this. And there's a very important effect that arises here. So A turns out to be independent, to be the same for all closed string at a given level. And then you have this exponential suppression coming from this 1 over sinh cancel exactly with the exponential growth coming from the density of state, because we need to sum over all state. And this cancels exactly, so it's neither zero at high energy, it's neither exponentially infinite. And then you've got a power law, and then you can calculate things interesting. This cancellation is very important. So now let's go to next leading order. And my branching fraction calculation. And then we're going to suppose that there's open string around, so that means there should be another brain. And for the simplicity, I'm putting them in the same throat at the moment. This is one just to de-simplicate. And there's like multiple diagrams that can come in. Also, I should mention that if it's a two-pair production now, it's no longer a current state, but rather a squeeze state. But essentially, the analysis goes through the same way. You can go again, essentially generalizing the Ulambu-Malasena to one loop. And these have been, well, actually, here, these have been looked at already in a paper by Chen. So now the idea, though, these are complicated to calculate. I would like to focus on only one of them for the moment, namely that one. And that's because, so this is, okay, this boundary here, Wiggly, is DD bar. This boundary, so this is a cylinder amplitude. This boundary is a D brain, and I'm producing two open string on that boundary. And the reason why this one seems interesting at first is because naively, we have to do the calculation completely here, naively has the same exact cancellation between the two exponentials. And this is a rather non-trivial, actually. It's really because I have a factor of 1/2 coming from the fact that when you relate energy with level, for open string, it's, you get a factor of 1/2 compared to closed string, but you also get a factor of 2 because you're emitting two of them. And so it turns out that just cancel, assuming that you know you don't get any funny behavior from the loop integral. So, yeah, so this is the idea, just to look at this diagram. Okay. One thing that makes this calculation much harder than the disk amplitude is the fact that we need more than the zero mode part of the boundary state. We need actually the full boundary state, because we're going to project it on the brain, the Newman boundary states, and so we're going to need all the oscillators in this. And there's been essentially two representations, not really two different, but two representations of the boundary state. By one here, which is a certain limit of the state, but finishing. Okay, so this is a boundary state here that's been proposed in their sense. And this one shows up in this kind of calculation terms that are badly divergent. And so we are, as first preliminary result, it seems like this one, as far as this physical calculation makes sense, is better to use than this one here. And I'll be happy to discuss this with anybody else. And there's other technical tests I would like. And there's other way also to work this out with boundary string field theory. And again, I can discuss it. Thank you.
Well, that was approaching the gong. Our next speaker, Marcus Berg, is going to talk about orientifold prepotentials.
Can you hear me, Marco? All right. So I'd like to switch pace a little bit from the previous speaker, who was talking about the exit from inflation. I'd like to talk about the very beginning. So as Michael Ahak was saying in his talk, you know, we're still trying to understand the supersymmetric case, where you're still trying to understand the orientifold effective action in the presence of these, you know, brains and orientifold planes. Yep, I'll put it. So, okay. All right. So this talk
It's just a technical appendix to the talk by Michael Hawk. So I'm just going to do some elementary mathematics. So for those of us who were at the Fields Institute last week, there was a lot of impressive mathematics. I'm just going to do some very simple steps just to show those who are non-experts how you do this kind of computation and what sort of goes into it. So that's all I hope to get to do in 5 minutes. So the typical result you get here, as in our forthcoming paper, is me and Michael Hawk in Boyd's course. So the typical thing you get out from these string scattering amplitudes is a non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. It looks like this. And it depends on the Wilson line A and the complex structure modulus U. So A tells you where the free band is located on the space I'm torus, whose complex structure is given by U. So this is the kind of function that you typically get out of the string scattering amplitude. So what I'm showing you here is the fact that in this particular example, you're looking at an n equals 2 or antifold. So it's a K3 times T2 compactification. In that case, you expect to be able to write the Keller potential, in particular, in terms of a pre-potential. So you expect to have some kind of formula of this form, you see down here, that you write sort of some relative of this function as this kind of sum. So the challenge here, which is very similar to something that was done in an old paper by Harvey and Moore, is to take this function in this form and rewrite it in a form which is amenable to this representation. So all you have to do is follow a couple of simple steps using this little toolbox. So first you realize that you can split off the part which is m equals 0. And if you take m equals 0 here, you see that n factors out with this expression. And then you can just use this elementary formula and write some, you get a quartic polynomial in A. So there's a quartic term here, and that will be important at the very end. And then you, after you split off this part, you use this representation to sort of take this denominator and put it up on top here, so include it in the exponential. And then you use the standard trick of Poisson resummation. So you Poisson resum after you've done this trick, and then you see that one part of your exponential is sort of flipped. And then you end up with a representation that looks something like this. So where you see the flipping here, I talked about this is sort of a Poisson resummation effect, and this is what you had already, in a way. And then what you get is a representation of a Bessel function. And this may be familiar to some of the experts, but again, I'm just doing this for the non-experts. Just a little comment for the experts that in the standard case, you can get a K1 here. That's a very simple representation. In our case, we get a K3/2, which also has a very simple representation. So again, so just use this. You get a representation that involves this Bessel function. You use the explicit simple representation of the Bessel function, and then you're able to write it in a form that involves sums over polylogarithms, like this lie, this polylogarithm here. And we do this, I'm just going to flash the result. My point was, you want to get a form like this. However, you don't get a form like this, you get this quartic term I was mentioning before. This doesn't look really familiar if you look at the Harvey Moore paper. But actually, after you sum over all the different surfaces you're instructed to sum over, that term actually cancels. So then you will have a cubic polynomial, and then you can write it in the form you want. So you get some expression like this, and again, this is not, the details aren't so important, I'm just trying to give you the flavor, sort of how you do these kind of computations. So you get this kind of cubic polynomial that you can then sum over the relevant diagrams, and you get this little f here, which is up to constant the prepotential. So what I've done now is the continuous Wilson line generalization of the case where you don't have this phase factor. And now, in terms of inflation, what you do is you interpret these three-band scalars, this A, as the inflaton, and then you try to expand and you look at mass contributions in the effective potential. So again, this is due to these sources, because as Michael was pointing out, this doesn't happen in type 2. You don't get this contribution that we're computing the torus amplitude that contributes to this amplitude is actually zero. So this is just trying to give you some flavor with the kind of computation you need to do to understand these effective actions. And so it's sort of a subtitle of this talk could have been A Day in the Life of Michael, Marcus, and Boris.
I figure Gary wants to get his money worth out of the gong. Our next speaker is Andrew Tully, string propagation on bouncing cosmologies.
Okay, so the question I'm trying to address in this work is whether a bouncing cosmology, so that's a collapsing universe to an expanding universe, is possible in string theory. And the approach I'm going to take is, it's working now, the approach I'm going to take is to assume that there are weak coupling bouncing solutions to string theory and then look at what happens on the world sheet. And main motivation for this work is that there's kind of, I don't have time to explain, but there's a strong similarity between general anisotropic cosmological spacetimes. As you go towards the singularity, the low-level excitations of the string behave very similarly to strings on plane wave spacetimes, which are obtained by taking the Penrose limit of the cosmological spacetimes. So the upshot of this is very similarly to when you think about scalar fields on curved spacetimes, for FRW spacetimes, you know that the simple story is that you have a horizon because of the cosmological expansion or contraction. And when the modes are inside the horizon, they're oscillatory. And when they go outside of the horizon, they freeze. And you have a growing and decaying mode. And this whole story is very important in inflation. When you look at strings on FRW spacetimes, then a kind of intriguingly similar story applies, that there's some analog of the cosmological horizon, a kind of string horizon, which occurs at L string squared divided by the cosmological horizon. So that's L string squared times the Hubble constant. And if you think of a particular string state like a graviton with wavelength lambda physical, then when the wavelength of the string state is larger than this string horizon, the world sheet modes are oscillatory. And that's the kind of normal behavior you expect when we quantize the string on Minkowski space. But when the physical wavelength of the string goes inside this string horizon, then the world sheet string modes freeze in an analogous way, and they have a kind of growing and decaying mode. And as was mentioned earlier, the reason why we're interested in modes whose physical wavelength is smaller than the string scale is basically everything of interest today emerged at the beginning of inflation from modes whose wavelengths were smaller than the string scale. And what happens when you think about strings on curved spacetimes is analogously to quantum field theory in curved spacetimes, the definition of the vacuum on the world sheet, which you need to define the states, becomes ambiguous. And you have a similar story that you can define in and out states by whether the string coordinate becomes like a positive frequency mode in the future or the past. And in general, there's some Bogoliubov transformation between the two. And in quantum field theory and closed spacetimes, this Bogoliubov transformation gives rise to particle creation. And the similar interpretation here is you get string mode excitation. So that means that, for example, if you send into the bouncing universe a graviton, it could come out as some excited string state. So that's the effect of the expansion on the strings. But this only becomes a significant effect when the physical wavelength of the mode becomes comparable to the string horizon, which occurs at L string squared over the ordinary cosmological horizon. And so to cut to the conclusions, something I haven't been able to talk about is one of the implications of the work I'm doing is that kind of cosmological singularities fall into two classes. If you imagine that you bounce at the string scale and the cosmological singularity is regulated, depending on the behavior of the original singularity, in some cases the evolution of strings through the bounce is largely insensitive to what happens at the bounce, and in some cases strongly sensitive to the bounce. And as I've discussed, because of this Bogoliubov transformation on the world sheet, what can happen is that the strings typically emerge in excited states, so the expectation value of the mass of the string becomes of order of the string scale. And this means, you know, that the nature of the... So you send in some gravitational wave, and it comes out as something entirely different, some excited string state. And this has been used in the past as a criterion to say perhaps that a bounce is not possible because you're producing these excited strings. And in general, this feature is going to have important implications for cosmologies that use the idea of the bounce and whether it's possible or not. So.
We have time for one question. So I was confused about something. Why at the beginning are you talking about anisotropic cosmologies? Does that your results are? I mean, it depends on what type of bounce you have.
Yeah, the results I'm doing generalized to anisotropic cosmologies, and the analogy with plane waves works better for anisotropic cosmologies. It's a long story that I can't go into in five.
So
minutes.
These results are supposed to be general regardless of what gives you the bounce. Is this radiation-dominated bounce, or
it depends. There's two. Basically, it falls into two classes. And in one case, the evolution of the strings through the bounce is largely insensitive to what happens at the bounce. In the other case, it's strongly sensitive.
Okay. Thank you. So our next speaker is Joshua Fries, whose family decided to spell the name wrong, the last name. String creation in cosmologies with a time-varying dilaton.
Thanks. So this was work done a little while back with Steve Gubser and Indrajit Mitra. And our main concern was just trying to figure out how particle or string production works in time-varying backgrounds. So just a brief explanation of the background that we chose. We start with the 11-dimensional bosonic part of the supergravity action. And we choose a nonzot so that when we reduce to 2a, we're left with only NSNS fields. In particular, this parameter h is just some constant. And what we're left with is one parameter family of solutions in 11 dimensions. And just for reference, I'll call that parameter q. And an interesting feature, though, is that the four-dimensional Einstein frame is actually Q-independent. It's just some power law expansion. From an 11-dimensional perspective, the brain separation, or if you like, the 10-dimensional string coupling, is Q-dependent, and it can do any number of things. It can start out at zero or even finite separation and go out to infinity, or it can even start at infinity, come into some finite separation, and move back out to infinity. And if you define a four-dimensional axial dilaton, the solution in the space of the axial dilaton starts at some singular point and follows, and time follows parametrically along this poorly drawn semicircle and approaches some regular point back at late times. So we took an effective field theory approach to calculating the resulting string production, and in general, at least to lowest order in alpha prime, any given string mode phi should satisfy some scalar wave equation like this. And in general, solutions to this equation are fairly hard to come by. But for a particular choice of our one parameter q, the 10-dimensional string frame metric actually simplifies considerably. And for KK0 modes and also for large masses, the wave equation also simplifies a lot. And the solutions to this simplified wave equation are exact, and they're just given in terms of confluent hypergeometric functions. From that, we can calculate in standard fashion the particle occupation numbers. And what we find is something actually fairly interesting, namely that at large masses, this parameter lambda is going to infinity. So this term is disappearing. And what we're left with is some constant particle occupation number at large masses. And in particular, the consequence is that at large mass, since beta squared approaches a constant, when you integrate over the Hagedorn density of states, you actually get an infinite amount of string production. And despite the fact that we chose a particular value of q to do this analytic derivation, we can show through various approximations that this actually applies for general q. So if there's one thing to be learned from these 5 minutes, it's that the back reaction of created strings is actually important on the metric that you use. And this is a fairly generic consequence since we started with only NSNS fields. So, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the next slide will probably answer your question. I mean, basically, what the next slide will do is attempt to take into account alpha prime corrections. And the end result will be that we can actually get finite string production in a somewhat admittedly hokey manner by taking into account alpha prime corrections. Fair enough? All right. So, So if we want to take into account back reaction of the strings that were created, we can do so by including their free energy into the action. The free energy in general is going to depend on the scale factors of the metric and the temperature that the strings are at. The problem is that if you generically derive the equations of motion from this action, what you find is that there are quantities which in general, dimensional quantities which in general will go to infinity at early times. So, but this is not particularly realistic. String or alpha prime corrections to the action should at some point kick in. And it's plausible to think that these quantities should actually saturate somewhere near the string scale at very early times. So our conjectured solution, if we assume that the scale factor on the compact manifold is constant, and if we also assume that these dimensional quantities, which were previously blowing up, actually saturate at some constant value at asymptotically early times, then what we can find is actually a solution that is, in the string frame, is a de Sitter solution with Hubble constant near the string scale, and that the energy density of these strings is increasing in time exponentially. This parameter phi dot infinity is the asymptotic value of the first derivative of the dilaton, which is negative. And whereas our previous solution started out at some singular point and followed along this path to some regular point in the future, the conjecture is that this solution can actually be matched onto the solution at later times. The exact matching is a bit difficult to come by because of the one parameter family and some issues regarding the various signs of some of these constants that some of these other objects that we assumed approach constant value at early times, but nevertheless, it's what we think could at least help to resolve the problem of infinite string production. Thanks. Is there a thing?
I'm afraid we already had our question. So our last speaker, Steve Morris, is going to talk about stabilizing G2 moduli.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk about stabilizing G2 moduli. And this is based on work that was done with Andre Lucas and Beatrice De Carlos. And more details are available in these two papers here. So the reason we were interested in compactifications in a G2 Hilonic manifold is that compactifications of M theory on them give n equals 1 supersymmetric theories in four dimensions. In particular, we considered a certain class of G2 Hilonomy manifolds, which are compact and were constructed by Dominic Joyce, that are based on orbifolds of seven-dimensional tori. The resulting orbifold singularities can then be resolved, for example, by blowing them up, that is, by replacing them with a two-cycle. So then on those manifolds, we can think that there are two sets of moduli. We have these TIs, which kind of describe the overall size of the original torus. So, I mean, there will be seven of those, and they correspond, roughly speaking, to the seven radii of the original torus. And then there are these U moduli that describe, that arise from the orbifold singularities, and they kind of describe the size and orientation of these blow-ups. To stabilize those moduli, of course, we need to know both the Cayley potential and the superpotential. And the Cayley potential, it turns out, has this form here. Roughly speaking, it's the log of the volume of the manifold. And this first term here corresponds to the volume of the original torus. And then there are these corrections that come from the blowing up. In fact, we would expect there also to be higher order corrections, to be higher order terms in the ratio of U and T, but we don't really know how to calculate those. So this Cayley potential is only valid so long as U is much, much less than T. That is, so that the blow-ups are much smaller than the overall size of the original torus. We also need to know the superpotential, and we use this superpotential here, which is based on flux and on membrane instantons, and these linear terms come from flux, and the exponential terms come from membrane instantons wrapping three cycles on the G2 Hilonomy manifold. So the easiest thing to do is to look for minima that are both supersymmetric and have a vanishing cosmological constant. The location of those minima depends solely on the superpotential, so we don't, for example, have to worry about the fact that the Cayley potential is an approximation. They're given by the place where the superpotential and its derivatives all vanish, so we can solve that equation, and we get these results for the moduli here. The n's are just integers, which are positive so long as this ratio inside the logarithm, these are even if the ratio inside this logarithm is positive and they're odd otherwise. There's also a kind of, you have to tune the parameters in the superpotential to allow this minimum to exist, and that tuning is given by this equation here. And then also this final constraint actually allows for the existence of an infinite number of minima if you choose the signs of this m and mu appropriately. So I can show a picture of one of these minima here. I've also plotted the lines where the F-terms, which describe supersymmetry breaking, vanish, and you can see that the minimum is, roughly speaking, where they cross, so you can see that it's a supersymmetric minimum. I should also say that this plot is for a slightly simplified case where there's just a single T modulus and a single U modulus. So we can also find supersymmetric minima that have a negative cosmological constant. Again, looking at a simplified case where there's a single T modulus and a single U modulus, the moduli in that case take these two values here. And again, I've got a picture. And again, you can see that the minimum is at the point where both the F terms vanish. So you can see that it's a supersymmetric minimum. So finally, we can also have minima where supersymmetry is broken. And I've just presented one case here, and again you can see that because the minimum here is displaced from the line where the F terms vanish, you can see that supersymmetry is broken in this case. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Question?
The membrane instance on. Yeah. No, well, that's really, I think that's one of the, I guess, no, not really. That's just something that arises from the features of the model. Yeah. I think that's kind of inevitable. The other problem as well is actually it's not so much to do with the supergravity approximation, it's also to do with the fact that this Kähler potential for the U modulus to be much smaller than the T modulus, you require the T modulus to be quite large. And it just turns out that because the T modulus is, roughly speaking, the logarithm of this ratio, that means that those parameters have to be quite large.
Well, let's thank all our speakers again. And at this point, I think I'm going to ring the dinner gong.